The 2005 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 352, a paper entitled A Church Observed, Chapter 2, with presenters David G. Pace and Cheryl Pace.
Okay, my name is David Pace, and we're going to start this session with, looks like we have a quorum. You think I should wait? No. Okay. No, we need to start. The tape is running, and obviously we're going to have thousands of people listening to this tape later, so we need to get going. And actually, I'm supposed to say that this is by ticket only, but since there's so few of us, I think that anybody that you want to drag in here, we'd be happy to take. I'm doing this off the cuff since our presenter is obviously the smarter of all of us. She's over next door at the Love, Sex, and Transgression session, subtitled Approaching the Unapproachable in Mormon Biography. It's about the sex lives of the brethren. That's the that's how I interpret it. Anyway, it's full. Yeah.
That's tough competition.
Very tough competition. Anyway, welcome. This is session 352, A Church Observed, Chapter 2, with David Pace, myself, and Cheryl Pace. Cheryl is a housewife and a poet, a journalist, and a gardener. She has an essay, which I would highly recommend, personal essay, coming out in Eriantum. The next Eriantum, which is the Journal of Mormon Literature, sponsored by the Association for Mormon Letters. I think it's a powerful piece and would highly recommend that. Anything else? Okay, I'll introduce myself. My name is David Pace for the third time, and still David Pace. I am an editor, sections editor of Eriantum magazine, which I'm trying to plug as much as possible, so please buy it at eriantum.org. Eriantum, incidentally, is the is a Book of Mormon word, which means many waters. So it's a great name for a literary journal. It's also literary and film, I should add. We're both going to be talking about the abstract, which is, are Mormons a self-hating people, just as arguably blacks and women once were? We believe they are. Can self-hating people take either compliments or criticisms to heart and be affected by them? We believe they can't. So I'll turn the time over to Cheryl, and then I'll follow up.
They tell us we have to make a tape. It's very silly to be up here with so few of you down there. I should be down there, but so it goes. All right, let's work that out. A Church Observed is the second part from last year when we came in with part one. It's a series of essays. Our abstract poses the question, are Mormons a self-hating people, just as arguably blacks and women once were? And while that is the question we want to suggest an answer to, we must first answer the question, I think, as to whether anti-Mormonism in the community is real or imagined. It's my understanding that a self-hating group only exists where a group with minority status is visibly different from a therefore hostile host community. So there really are two questions before us. Is anti-Mormonism a fact? And as a consequence, have the LDS become a self-hating community? That said, last year David and I stood before you and tried to tell you what we find valuable about Mormonism to the broader culture, why we continue to live here, not in spite of, but largely because of the Mormon community. Early in that discussion, I confessed to an all-too-willing initiation into vaulting anti-Mormonism, but later I tripped all over myself when I was asked to describe the particulars of that initiation. It seemed then, and it seems now, altogether harsh enough to admit that the LDS are the most despised people I have ever lived among. Every aspect of your way of believing is the subject of ridicule, disdain, and suspicion. Further, the worst of my anti-Mormonism is continuously learned from Mormons themselves. It is learned from the suspicion, mistrust, and/or condescension they routinely express about one another. It is learned from the propensity of LDS individuals to conclude disparaging remarks about their own community with standard disclaimers, "I don't go to church, I'm not a believer, my family was different, fill in the blank, why, the point is, I'm not a typical Mormon." Most of us are aware of at least some of the polarity in our city. Our mayor calls it a religious divide, and there does seem to be a clear dividing line between the LDS and the non-LDS. My father-in-law's in the front row. I'm not divided on how I feel about him. But the non-LDS and the LDS seem to be in perfect agreement about what, if not who, the typical Mormon is. We even refer to him essentially the same way. When we non-Mormons are describing a Mormon we like or admire in some way, we say, well, he's not your typical Mormon. When my Mormon friends are describing what they like about a fellow Mormon, they say, well, he's not your typical Mormon. We're separating respectable Mormons, I think, from the most negative stereotype in our city and arguably the nation, the typical Mormon. Every Mormon I know, without exception, has at some point made the point that she is not typical. The message is obvious, although not obvious enough. It took me over a decade to get that message. Typical Mormon is a slur. So who is this typical Mormon? She is provincial and pretentious, a self-righteous, defensive, and inaccessible stranger to both logic and empathy, who wears a patent, unreadable smile. She is to be feared in that she is as programmed as any robot and will do as she is told. Our community well-being, therefore, is entirely dependent upon the benevolence of the forces that control her. And as those are LDS forces, we suspect that they are seldom benevolent and ever myopic. The typical Mormon, who is, of course, not any of the Mormons I know, is a veritable bottom feeder in the American pecking order. I have felt confident as I shared information about her in the form of speculation, interpretation, and rumor dispensed as fact to me by reputable people in responsible public roles, and then, of course, validated without hesitation for me by Mormons themselves. I have felt confident, perhaps even vindicated, as I have used obsolete phrases like Christian heresy, which is how the LDS Church is defined in a pamphlet authored by a former Mormon and available inside the door of the historic and heavily trafficked Trinity Church in Manhattan. Do any of us really believe heresy has any meaning in the 21st century? Would I have taken the term seriously had it not been used to describe Mormons? In truth, I can't imagine I would have. I have seriously considered whether a loaded term like cult describes the LDS Church, this in spite of the fact that Rodney Stark, a sociologist whose work I much admire, defines cult in such a way that the LDS Church simply does not qualify. I have seriously considered on other occasions whether the LDS Church is a totalitarian system or an antiquated patriarchy, this in spite of the fact that if the arguments are sound, as set forth by another admirable sociologist, Richard Sennett, then the LDS Church cannot be accurately described as either totalitarian or patriarchal. For an embarrassing number of years, nothing motivated me to interrogate a lengthy list of assumptions about Mormonism and Mormons that could only have been unreasonable as it was dignified by nothing other than general consensus. General consensus would have me believe that the Mormon faith is somehow less rational than mine, and that to be Mormon is to be other than human, as I understand my humanity. The Mormons I have been asked to believe, and I have asked myself to believe, are alien to the common humanity that the rest of us share. Is alien overstating the problem? Well, maybe. Maybe it is. But last week, my grandson was watching the international hit series, The Simpsons, and the dialogue went this way. Lawyer, you, sir, are a moron. Homer, a Mormon, but I'm from Earth. Everywhere I've lived, there has been prejudice toward one group or another, and all of these, in their place and time, had something in common. The groups at the bottom of the local pecking order were disenfranchised in some way, but they were hardly a blip on the radar of my personal conscience, because the circumstances so seldom existed that brought my bigotry to the surface. In Utah, however, the circumstances that bring our bigotry to the surface, in either the form of ready non-Mormon offensiveness or equally ready Mormon defensiveness, are nothing short of relentless. The Mormons, however, are not disenfranchised, and they look like me, and they enjoy a certain measure of power coast to coast. In Utah, few would contest that Mormons dominate the entire power structure of politics, education, and media. How then do we account for the scale and scope of anti-Mormonism? Stephen L. Carter, in his book, The Culture of Disbelief, writes, when the Supreme Court in 1879 sustained the authority of the state to prosecute Mormons for polygamy, the Supreme Court understood perfectly well that the Mormons could not be permitted to be different. Even if it was required by religious belief, the court wrote, the practice of polygamy was, quote, subversive of good order, end quote. In other words, hatred of Mormons caused other people to act disorderly. Are Mormon convictions still subversive of good order? Is it a defensible idea that Mormonism is near or at the top of the hate list in America, with disastrous consequences to its membership, and even more disastrous, a legacy for future generations of Mormons? Well, I think so. Anti-Mormonism, as compared to the other prejudices of our day, seems to me to be a bigger deal. I know any number of people who are willing to put a concentrated effort into fighting prejudice against Islam and Muslims in the wake of 9/11, an event I lived through in New York. But not one who is willing to put one moment into your defense. If you saw me last year, you know this is what I do. Historically, we can perhaps agree that America has been religiously defined by a great troika of Jews, Catholics, and mainline Protestants. In my view, it still is. The Judeo-Christian troika defines the majority and reduces Mormonism to minority status, even here in Utah, where the Mormons outnumber the rest of us. It is not less than an irony to me that Mormonism seems to be an unwelcome minority in its central city and native country. And while that unwelcome Mormon minority moves about powerfully in the broader culture, I am left to wonder why they cannot seem to establish any meaningful, intimate connections to it, to me. Who are you who share public roles and positions with the broader culture, who share family with me, and yet are somehow condemned in your private lives, in the words of journalist Robert J. Lewis, to seek out your own cloistered kind at the expense of a world that is reduced to your blinkered conception of it. And who am I? Once and often still so willing to participate in the anti-Mormon conversation, thank you, to believe that Mormons are controlled, mindless, programmed. No matter how disparaging the conversation about Mormons, I don't bat an eye. It does not seem unusual. It is never surprising. Modern anti-Mormonism is, in my view, fully acceptable. It was once violent, and when it was still acceptable. Anti-Mormonism seems to have been acceptable for as long as Mormonism has existed. For me, as part of an interfaith marriage, it is not less than a fact of daily life in Utah, in almost any and every situation, public and private, to greater and lesser degree. Over time, I have come to suspect that anti-Mormonism is unique among prejudices on at least four very frightening counts: intensity, extent, duration, and distribution. The intensity or sheer energy with which Mormons are disdained in my presence intimidates me. If I can refrain from participating, I usually absorb it in silence. On the rare occasion when I have attempted to question the validity of it, I have been discounted or silenced. No one wants to hear any genuine defense of the LDS, least of all in the mixed company of those atypical LDS and non-LDS. We share the typical Mormon as our favorite joke and our favorite target. Arguably, he is the bridge across the mayor's religious divide. Around what will we bond so instantly if we cease to hold him in frightened contempt? I'm part of a liberal denomination. We announce proudly in our weekly church bulletin that we recognize and honor every baptism, including the Mormon baptism, and welcome all baptized individuals to our communion rail. We're headed in the right direction. I admire that, and I continue to tithe. We think everyone is legitimate regardless of race, creed, gender, or orientation. Everyone, that is, except a Mormon who is not in crisis. There can only be something profoundly wrong with a content Mormon. There is the problem for me, and the reason I have ceased to attend. Disparaging comments are made to me confidently and routinely, even within my own parish halls, and those disparaging comments are about my predominantly LDS family. They are about the majority of my closest friends. They are about my husband. 13 years ago, on my first Sunday in my first parish in Salt Lake City, the priest announced from the altar a sign-up sheet for an outing to Saturday's Voyeur at the Salt Lake Acting Company. Saturday's Voyeur has been rewritten and produced in Salt Lake City every year since 1978. Historically, it has been a scathing parody of LDS style, traditions, and belief, revolving around bouffant hairstyles, family home evening, missionary training, even one year, this one was my favorite, a trip to heaven where astonished Mormons were trying to understand why everyone else was there. Scathing or not, funny stuff. But Voyeur 2005 takes on far more than LDS lifestyle and belief, and has, in my view, traded the outrageous fun of parody for the oppressive badgering of invective. Voyeur, often called the cash cow of the Salt Lake Acting Company, is reputedly so much more profitable than other productions that it has long been the core of the Salt Lake Acting Company's financial stability. This is one of the only two equity theater houses in our city. Poking fun at Mormonism is profitable in Salt Lake in any number of ways. There's the infamous YBU t-shirt and the Salt Lake Temple shot glasses. There's Polygamy Porter beer and the new Mormon Girls cigar shop. 2 years ago, in my first Sunday in my second parish in Salt Lake City, a woman cornered me at coffee hour and bent my ear on the issue of Mormons, never imagining that we might not be in agreement. She views it as her calling to rescue young Mormons from a Mormonism, takes them into her home, and protects them from ward members who try to contact them. She is also the widow of a 40-year marriage to a Mormon man who did not leave the church, by whom she bore children, and whose family she continues to hold in contempt. If you imagine I admire her position, I assure you I do not. She and I are Episcopalians in Salt Lake City, where we pat ourselves on our oh-so-liberal, gay-friendly backs, but let's remember the full spectrum of what we will tolerate. We will tolerate Mormon bashing, and we will tolerate it even within our cathedral's walls. It is inconceivable to me that the things said about Mormons and ignored could be said aloud in public about any other group. That it happens as regularly as it does suggests that we assume we will not encounter disapproval, in my view, and implicates my clergy in a crime of omission. While it does seem much worse here, the extent or geographic domain of anti-Mormonism seems to be not confined to any particular city, state, or region. Anti-Mormonism seems to be a national phenomenon. For me, Martha Beck's most recent book stands as evidence. I ask myself, would a book bearing the subtitle, How I Lost the Episcopalians and Found My Faith, be of interest? I can pretty much promise you there's no Episcopalians that would bother it. Would Random House feel confident that they could sell a first printing of 75,000 copies? David's novel about growing up Mormon, which took first prize in category from the Utah Arts Council this year, was returned by a New York agent who said, I can't sell a Mormon hero who still has problems after he leaves the church. The anti-Mormon, it seems, is anyone. She comes from every race and creed. She comes from every profession and level of education. She comes from the streets and the national halls of power. She comes from anywhere. But she comes most especially from the heart of the Mormon fold. And that is what should concern us most, that Mormons themselves are ashamed of, at the very least embarrassed by, most other Mormons. Mormons demonstrate an insatiable need to see themselves as atypical, as having somehow graduated the nonsense. The LDS demonstrate, I think, the devastating symptomology of a self-hating ethnicity. The child born to minority self-hatred is looking, like all children, for approval, I think. Well, a child, I suspect he adopts the outer world's view of him and no shame. So he clings to his own and tries to see them and him as exceptional. But even as he does, his experience tells him he is not exceptional, just human. He learns to perform for the approval he needs. He performs the exceptional Mormon for his own community, and he performs the atypical Mormon for the broader community. His fragile identity is, I think, becoming entirely dependent upon public opinion, which means he has no authentic identity at all. At his core, I think he believes that his minority superiority is fraudulent, and that the negative Mormon stereotype in the broader culture defines him. If that is so, then one could argue that as an adult, the Mormon individual is likely to have but two choices if she is to disassociate herself from the negative stereotype she has come to believe in. She can choose to be cloistered among her own kind, whether as loyalist or dissident makes very little difference, or to jettison herself from their midst, only to discover that she cannot run away from herself, and likely to be ever haunted by the group she has left behind. In desperation, She will likely seek a condition or milieu designed to bolster her low self-esteem. She is the sort who will shape herself into a perfect representative of culturally defined beauty at any cost. She is the sort to become the classic overachiever. She is the sort who will lust after celebrity in whatever way is available, and it will never be enough. This is a description of a person condemned to proving himself. His is a competitive life, and he only feels good when he is winning, when he is standing in the spotlight. As none of us can be standing in the spotlight all the time, then arguably self-deception and endless fantasies of winning become essential. Fantasies of being the most intelligent, the most beautiful, the most distressed, the most faithful, the most victimized, the most fill in the blank. Lewis describes minority self-hatred as an unbearable humiliation from which there is often no escape other than self-deception. In my view, what is most obvious about the problem of minority self-hatred is that it can only exist where there is intolerance in the broader community. If that's so, then the non-Mormon community simply must participate in any healing of the Mormon community. Therefore, I believe I have an obligation to be prepared to refute the false claims of anti-Mormonism and to do so at every opportunity. As an aside, perhaps you see a parallel here and will consider that you share with me a similar obligation to know and refute the false claims of homophobia. That said, nothing is more mysterious to my Mormon family, my Mormon friends, even David, than my interest in Mormons, by whom, quite frankly, I'm surrounded. For David, it often becomes more than mysterious. It becomes downright terrifying. He imagines my whitewashing a monster, handing a victim's sense of superiority to those typical Mormons that you and I fear. But I'm not trying to tell you that you're better than me. I'm desperately trying to tell you that you aren't worse. Not more exclusive, not participating in stranger, less defensible beliefs, not more bigoted, not more conformist. We are identical in the fullness of our humanity, and quite frankly, so are our institutions. I attended the Association for Mormon Letters conference this year. I didn't feel even a little out of place because the issues being discussed there were not specifically Mormon issues. The issues were artistic issues. But, well, I may not have felt out of place. It soon became clear to me that I was indeed out of place. When I identified myself as non-Mormon and addressed a question to a student filmmaker at BYU, he wanted to know, why are you there? He was quite hostile, actually. He wanted to know why I was interested. I've asked myself, if I mostly lived among Hindus, whether my interest in them would also be confusing. Is it so hard to believe that anyone outside the Mormon fold gives a damn about you, about transpersonal art with Mormon characters and situations? I sat with a young Mormon mother during lunch. She has published 3 books in 3 years with children at home, one of them severely autistic. When I was clearly impressed with her achievement, she said by way of clarification, well, I mean, I've only published with Covenant books. Having published with an LDS publishing house clearly diminished her achievement in her eyes, and she assumed it did in mine. So I have a hard task ahead of me, I guess. I'm trying to make contact with a majority in my city who are self-deprecating and so suspicious of themselves that they are suspicious of any outsider who wants to make contact with them, and they reject out of hand anyone who is trying to identify with them. However hard the task ahead for me, though, I believe the task ahead for you is even harder. If you are to undo the harmful effects of minority self-hate, then I think you must, in Lewis's words, evolve your own origins. That is, I think you must interrogate everything you believe about yourselves, even your most cherished values, opinions, tenets of faith, traditions, and history, everything, in order to own your own souls, to move confidently among non-Mormons without ready defensiveness in your fist, knowing you would choose your group even if you had not been born to it. As convert, you would choose it again. Even the ex-Mormon is, I think, confronted with this awesome task of self-interrogation right to the bone marrow if he is to move confidently forward, knowing that he would leave again. I appreciate that interrogation of official positions is likely an especially hard task for loyalist Mormons to consider. From the outside, it appears as though the very linchpin of Mormonism is authority, an authority born of restoration as opposed to reformation. If the Mormon Church is a primary civilizing force in an increasingly uncivilized world, and I think I can defend the idea that it is, and if the mind, in the mind of the LDS individual, the success and duration of that civilizing force rests upon respect for and obedience to its authority structure, then no reasonable person can expect him to do anything that will undermine the authority of the Mormon hierarchy, not ever. In the voting booths, as everywhere, he will choose, like me, the lesser of evils in his own eyes. He will protect the civilizing force, which makes him not mindless, but mindful of the greater good. And if we want to make him to make a better choice, we must give him a better choice. Maybe this explains the failure of so many organized efforts to impact either the public behavior of the faithful Mormon or the official LDS position. We imagine that reason, ridicule, or guilt are effective tools of persuasion in matters of faith. A way of persuasion that does not undermine church authority has not been put forth. The first order of business, then, it seems, is for those of us concerned with church policy and position to determine how the established position of LDS authority might be reconsidered, questioned, maybe even impacted, without collateral damage, without loss of respect. David and I believe it can be done, and it's the subject of authority we would like to address next year. Meanwhile, I think it is reasonable to assume that in any of the systems to which we belong, no matter how deeply felt our allegiance to any one of them, we will eventually face the necessity of personal choice. I think I will know if and when a hard line is drawn between my America and opposition to a preemptive strike on another nation, where I will have to stand. I think I will know if and when a hard civil rights line is drawn between the heterosexual and homosexual communities, where I will have to stand. I think I will know if and when a hard, prejudicial line is drawn between non-Mormons and Mormons in the community, where I will have to stand. I think I'll know, because the question I will ask myself is not, where do I belong, but where lies my responsibility? I think you are, most of all, a people with a rare sense of responsibility, and an even more rare inclination to serve the greater good. I think you aspire to remain true to your roots as a civilizing force in uncivilized territory, and I can think of few things more worth my time than to enlist in your cause as a religious minority. When I need you to enlist in my cause as a member of the civic minority in Utah, I hope you will feel the same way about me. If there will be Zion in Utah, I believe it can only be built upon the diverse backs of our steadfast alliance. Thanks.
Hello, my name is David, and I'm a typical Mormon. I was raised in a devout home and served a mission, married in the temple, served in many church positions. I divorced, became inactive, married an Episcopalian, and moved to New York City in an effort to distance myself from my past, my identity, my Mormonness. Eventually, I resigned my membership as a protest over what I thought was increasing fundamentalism expressed through the excommunication of intellectuals. But still, the religion of my childhood haunted me to the point sometimes of lunacy. As a writer, the only vein I have been able to mine has been what I've wryly come to call the Big M. Today, I live in Salt Lake City and have found myself again, still, attempting to make peace with David, the Mormon. Perhaps the problem for me started early when I learned what I was supposed to be as a Mormon. The list was long and detailed and began to accumulate when I became accountable at age 8. I was to be obedient to all authority, from parents to prophet. I was to keep myself morally clean, which started with controlling my thoughts. I was to follow the program set out for young men to advance in the priesthood, to grow line upon line in knowledge and goodness. I was to honor my birthright as one who was chosen in the premortal state to be a Saturday's warrior. I was to change the world, not to let the world change me. That was the short list. But by the time I was 14, I was already in trouble. I had a private, experientially informed, not so short list. I was lazy. I was selfish. I was disobedient at times. I was sexual. And mostly I was a doubter. In short, my experience did not corroborate my parents' expectation, my group expectations. My expectations. I assumed that it was only I who was failing, that everyone else was meeting the standards swimmingly. Eventually, however, through demonstration and simply putting a human two and a human two together, I came up with a very flawed human four. I suspected as early as high school that I was not the only one failing miserably to be the Latter-day Saint I was supposedly designed to be. I was not the only hypocrite. I was among them. At the same time, I was getting messages from the broader community outside Mormonism, a hostile majority who saw us as the hypocrites I knew we were, a substandard. The community of saints seemed to pick up the message, and enormous effort seemed to be made to defend us, to make us respectable, to raise us from a level of inferiority to a level of sophistication, to distinguish us via strange and lunatic theories of superiority. This need to defend who Mormons were and who I was led to a frenetic drive for achievement. My journal from the time I was 10 is filled with lists of things to do, schedules with nary a 15-minute rest period. Everything written in those pages speaks of an intolerance for failure, real or perceived, and the self-flagellating assumption that any time I did not meet any expectations, it was because I was weak, because I was sinful, because I was proud, because I was unworthy. Never did I question my expectations. And whenever I dared, in a spasm of honesty, to question what had become a stultifying imperative of family, faith, and church, I brought myself back into line within a paragraph. I lived then, as I do now, with a constant low-grade hum in my head telling me that I need to learn more, do more, be more accomplished, be a better Mormon, so that I can be seen as acceptable to a world that hated me. That was my internal life, my journaled life. Socially, I knew how to win approval from the world and from my community. To win approval, I only needed to perform the role of the Good Mormon. But the more I performed, the more hypocritical I felt, which required that I perform even more. Soon, I suspected other Mormons of falling short and turning to the same performance that I was. Soon, I suspected that they, like me, were hypocrites as well. Few, if any, were willing to openly admit that they were not that they were not who they performed. Needless to say, the whole scenario did not bode well for self-love or love and respect for my community. Last year, I talked about my three-stage sojourn in Mormonism. I've gone from loyalist to dissident and to a third stage, which I thought presumed a more even-handed approach to all things Mormon. And yet still, I am often seized with crushing hatred for who I am, what my community is, that they, we, are not merely hypocritical, but delusional, self-righteous, provincial, and simple. The list goes on as I move in more and more non-Mormon circles. Instead of healing of my inferiority complex, my lack of self-esteem, everyone around me seems superior to who I am and what I came from. When the self-hate gets really bad, I turn back to performance. The method acting dies hard, believe me, even in this third unnamed stage. In seconds, I can flip from self-abnegation to stratospheric grandiosity. One minute, I am damaged goods from a fundamentalist cult, and the next, I am heir to the only thing that makes sense in a sin-sick world. I and my fellow Mormons are either turds in God's toilet or ready to be catapulted into the celestial kingdom. We are all either badder or better than everyone else, but never players on a level playing field. Never mutually respected. Resonant voices in a conversation that the rest of the world routinely and productively participates in. In the end, as a third stage Mormon, I continually ask myself the following questions. Can I be okay if Mormons as a group are okay? Is what self-esteem I do muster only based on a reaction to what I perceive as Mormons not being okay? Why is it so important that I distinguish myself from the group I come from? What have I done to reclaim my love for the Mormons who I once tried to excommunicate from my life and to begin seeing them as acceptable? I don't know the answers to these questions. I would like to close by reading the final words of Alain Finkielkraut in his book, The Imaginary Jew, a term which suggests that Jewish identity is contingent on the presence of survivors he knew from the Holocaust. Finkielkraut's tortured account of his personal journey through Jewish identity in post-World War II France ends on a hopeful note, as I hope my own tortured account may someday as well. Quote, "The word Jew is no longer a mirror in which I seek my self-portrait, but where I look for everything I'm not, everything I'll never be able to glimpse by taking myself as a point of reference. Thinking I was living on the margins, lecturing all who would listen about my uniqueness, I was seized by an agonizing realization as a wordless accusation made bombast seem disgusting. Those who were the very inspiration of my Judaism were one day going to die. It was a disappearance I was unable to let my ignorance permit. A task was incumbent upon me, one in which the lyricism of the outcast had no part. Hysterical, I had been Jewish in order to be noticed. Now I learned loyalty and began the imperfect construction of a memory that would retain and transmit as much truth as possible about those beings who taught me that Judaism was something to love. Hello, my name is David, and I'm a typical Mormon. Thanks.
We'd like to thank our guests this evening for their for not going next door for the thing on sex. If there are any questions or comments, please feel free to come up and speak into the microphone since it's being recorded. If you have any stories, personal anecdotes about anti-Mormonism, self-hate, both from Mormons, ex-Mormons, and non-Mormons, please visit us up here. Oh, I guess you can
take it off, right?
Well, it depends on if somebody bothers to come up. Yes. Come on up. Actually, you don't have to come all the way up. I'll come to you. I'll be Oprah.
I was born a Mormon. Worked real hard at being a Mormon. My kids describe me as a militant Mormon mother. I was a mission president's wife. And as I studied the history of the church, I thought, why have we been so persecuted? And then I took the liberty of stepping out of my own arrogant shoes and stepping into the shoes of someone else, and I asked myself, how would I feel if someone came to me and said, I'm God's chosen. You're not. I have the truth because God loves me more than you. And you're condemned to live in hell the rest of your life. And as I watched as a mission president's wife and worked with the missionaries and went around mopping up disasters where the missionaries harmed, hurt, degraded, and abused people who loved their religion, their families, and their culture. And I thought, dang, I would be mad too. I remember the day that McConkie, Bruce, stood up in front of all these Mexican people who asked, when are we going to have a temple? And he said, when you're ready. So my journey has been the militant Mormon mother, the dedicated leader, and then one who asked, where is Christ in all this shit? And left. And said, my God doesn't do this. And so I went looking for my God. What a trip. What a magnificent trip. And as I've hung out with other religions, with people who are asking questions, who have the guts to look at their own beliefs and stand up and say, you know what? If it's going to be, it's up to me. I am the one that has to cure my lack of self-esteem by loving me, by recognizing that who I am, what I believe in, and my path has gotten me to where I am. And I just don't care who criticizes who as long as I'm not the one doing it. I have learned that there is something in every religion I've ever come across that is meaningful to me, and that if we act and love each other, but I have to do it first, the way I got along with the people in Mexico is I loved them. I ate their food. I learned their language, kind of crappily. I'll never be You know, they'll never think that I'm a Mexican, but by golly, I can communicate with them. Loved their culture, even though I didn't understand it. And for a while, we just said, you are in Mexico now. There was no other explanation for what was going on. But the bottom line is, we all have the same parents, whoever they are. We're all in this boat together. And as we learn to love and accept ourselves, it'll be easier to love and accept everybody else. And it won't matter whether somebody understands me or not. I don't care, because I am beginning to understand me and love me and be able to look in the mirror and say, I love you just as you are right now. And I think this is our responsibility, not to wait until somebody else decides we're okay. Wherever we are in the journey, we're okay if we can love ourselves. And then the contention of wondering who's judging us just goes away.
I have a comment and then a question. I do want to mention, I was a missionary too, and one of the things I will never forget is being in the MTC and in culture classes, being told that we needed to be very careful to disguise our contempt for the stupidity of Chinese religion, because if we ever let it show, it would interfere with our success as missionaries. That was a good lesson. Whatever you do, don't let your contempt for the people you're teaching show. I talked to Cheryl and David a little bit last night and didn't quite buy their argument. I understand it better now, and I think I agree with you up to the point that Mormons become self-hating when they see something to hate. And that there's a point at you have to get to a level, you have to become uncomfortable enough to find that. And then it is profound and horrible. And yes, you do ridicule and try to compensate, but there are many, many people who see nothing to hate. And I guess I also think about it in terms of whether or not this is a larger, broader movement in religion in general. Anybody see the movie Saved? It's pretty funny. It's got Mandy Moore at one point takes a Bible. She's got a Bible and she throws it at somebody, and the girl says, "This is not a weapon." And she says, "You need to learn something about the love of Christ." And Mandy Moore throws the Bible and says, "I am filled with the love of Christ." And if the extent to which this is not simply a Mormon phenomenon, but any fundamentalist group that feels very threatened by the world and very frightened of what's going on and aware of their status as outsiders, but also deeply, deeply, deeply superior. I guess I want you to tell me that it's not just Mormons. Okay, she did say that.
Oh, it is so not just Mormons. I'm absolutely certain I'm actually better than you are. I'm just pretending up here. I think the difference for Mormons is that there is a rise in the country. It's a very anti-religious movement. Particularly, of course, Christianity is getting a bad rap because the right hand of Christianity is now using the political system so effectively. When it was the left during the Martin Luther King and all the wonderful left-wing causes, we were all thrilled that there was very little separation of church and state. But now the right's caught on, and we're all very upset that there's this blending. It just depends on who's playing the game. I think that's safe to say. But in a group that organizes and is savvy. I don't see the Mormon population as fundamentalist. They have a fundamentalist faction, but we all do. We all have our extremists. But largely, they're highly progressive. They believe in a great deal of education. They are sort of for things like stem cell research. I mean, there's unique features of this group. And as I look at them, what happens is that their technological savvy and so forth has made them a visible minority. And you gather. You cloister with each other. And the moment that anyone with a minority status gathers, they become all the more visible. So that's required to become a self-hating minority. But how you learn your self-hate is, there's actually three types. The first absorbs hatred of the outer community. The second, who at least has an authentic identity, is absorbing a hatred for himself because he knows he disagrees with the group and can't really say so. So as he feels his difference, that translates to the self-hate. It's the third individual that is in the most trouble of all, and for me, it is the largest number of the Mormons with whom I'm close enough to have that kind of conversation, which is that they not only have the hatred of knowing they're in disagreement, that they have questions and so forth, or that they even disapprove, but they also know, they have the unique awareness of how much they are hated from the outside, because we can see you. You are not right-wing Christianity, but you are its poster child, because we can see you. You have gathered. I'm told we're out of time. Thank you very much. I'm sorry you missed what was going on next door.